Welcome once again to Pandora's Box. We are here with you again. It is Wednesday and we are here. Myself in physical form and mental form, and Rupert Le Bear. That's Rupert the Bear for anyone that doesn't speak French. And also the boy with the golden nug, the man that shall be eternally a child. That's an oxymoron for you. He goes by the name Bullwinkle.
You are listening to Pandora's Box on AW Radio. You also might be listening to us on YouTube or Spotify. Whichever platform you are listening to us on, we love you. We appreciate you. I am your host as always, Abadiah Penny Whistle. To the right of me, we have Rupert Le Bear.
What's up, what's up, what's up?
To the left of me, we have
bonjour, le suis.
The man with the golden nugget.
I'm Boo, ho ho.
Our Gaps Kids model.
Hello, everybody.
He's eternally stuck grateful. At the age of 14. And grateful. I'm grateful, everybody.
Grateful for it.
So yeah, we hope you've had a good week, everybody. We appreciate you. Thanks for being here with us. Mm-hmm. We've got plenty of shenanigans for you this evening. We got some interesting stories. We got some quick-fire facts.
Quick-fire facts, baby.
Bringing you all the stuff. Should we just start off with some quick-fire facts? Just real
yeah,
some
man,
off.
Get let's quick real them off.
We can talk about it. Facts. Talk all about right. it. Ponder about it. We can get into then into some cool mm-hmm. historical... you know, stories, oh and then my. Come back to some more facts later. Oh, baby.
Oh, baby.
For facts.
There was a Japanese warrior named Saito Musashibo Benkai. He is said to have killed in excess of 300 trained soldiers by himself while defending a bridge. He was so fierce in close quarters that his enemies were forced to kill him with a volley of arrows, and he died standing upright. Do you know what that reminds me a little bit of? This is the Japanese equivalent, a bit of like Harold Hardrada. You know the Battle of Stamford Bridge? You've probably heard a bit about that.
Oh, and I was thinking of Harold from Vikings. You know, King Harold. It's not Hardrada. It was.
No, you're thinking about. You're not. Wait a minute. King Harold. Oh, you're thinking about Harold. What's his
Fine
name?
Hair.
That's from the original Vikings, isn't it? Harold. No, it's King Finehair. Are you thinking of the latest one, Vikings Valhalla?
No.
You're thinking. You're thinking of the one with Ragnar Lothbrok.
Yeah.
And all that lot.
Harold.
He didn't die like that, though.
Finehair. No, but when you said Harold Hardrada, like that was the person I had
sorry.
In my head. You know.
Yeah.
What I mean?
So Harold Hardrada would have came after this. So in the Battle of Stamford Bridge. Which is one of the when the English throne was under dispute in 1066. Basically, Harold Godwinson claimed the throne of England, but several other people also claimed the kingdom of England. One of them being, at the time, his name was William the Bastard. He later on became known as William the Conqueror. And the other one was
upgrade.
Harold Hardrada. Yeah, I know. The other one was Harold Hardrada. So Harold Hardrada was supposedly the fiercest warrior in the whole of Europe at the time. Apparently he was like 6'7" or 6'8" or something, which in those days would have probably been about the equivalent of like 7 foot now, because people on the whole were a bit shorter. So yeah, apparently he was just like this absolutely brutal fighter. I think he might have even fought in the Varangian Guard in Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, when he was a young man as well. So when he was like in his early 20s, I think he like went all around Europe just like seeking, like, you know, like training and like finding acclaim. I'm pretty sure he fought in the Varangian Guard, which was like this elite group of warriors that were basically hired by the rulers of Constantinople, which at the time was probably the most impressive city on the planet. And they would hire the best Saxon and Viking warriors to almost like be their guards, and it was this elite group called the Varangian Guard, and the people of Constantinople, which at the time were basically, they were called like Byzantines, so it was almost like remnants of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that they were like more in terms of like their DNA. They were like Greek, but you know, Greek and Roman. And yeah, they used to hide. They were so impressed by like the ferocity and like the physical might of all the big Saxon and Viking warriors, and they, you know, obviously just like their whole culture and religion, obviously in that part of Europe, like Northern and Western Europe, was just like battle. You know, like literally, like how do you get into Valhalla? By being like an amazing warrior and dying in battle. So it was almost like their whole entire life purpose was just like battle, wasn't it? Whereas like in somewhere like Constantinople, cool, the people would have been a bit more almost like, if you think about how we would have been day to day,
civilized.
Yeah, so they were more interested in like drinking wine, going to the theatre,
having orgies.
Exactly. Whereas, I mean, the Vikings and the Saxons definitely liked an orgy too. Yeah. But do you know what I mean? They were just like, everything was just like, from the moment they were born, it would have just been like amazing epic tales of like warriors, and everything that you would have been brought up with was like, be the best warrior you can be, you know what I mean? So they had these amazing guards. And yeah, so I think Harald Rodder, he was part of the Varangian Guard for a while, but then, as you know, he went back to Norway. He was king of Norway, and he thought that he deserved the throne of England. I can't remember the exact specifics, but he was under the impression that he would become king of England. But Harald Godwinson was as well, and so as well was William the Bastard in Normandy, who was also a descendant of Rollo from Vikings. So in a way, all these people, they're actually like a bit related. So Harald Godwinson, he was like half Viking, half Saxon. Obviously Harald Harada was a Viking, and William the Conqueror, as he would be known, was also descended from Rollo. Obviously, the Normandy to this day, Normandy in France, Normandy originally was like Northman's land, and then that sort of became Normandy, because that was the land that was given to the Vikings who settled in northern France to essentially protect France from other Vikings and other raiders. It was more like a strategic move from the Franks. Franks obviously basically being like what are modern day French people. But yeah, Harald Hardrada, that reminds me of like the Japanese version of the story of Harald Hardrada at the Battle of Stamford Bridge. So apparently, actually at Stamford Bridge, the literal bridge itself, there was this bit where it was a very, very close battle between the army of Harald Godwinson and the army of Harald Hardrada. And apparently Harald Hardrada stood on the bridge on his own with like a massive Dane axe, what it's known. And a Dane axe is basically, it's almost like a really long, massive axe.
Warhammer.
Yeah, but an axe. Yeah, and apparently he was almost just like 300ing it. Do you know what I mean? You know, obviously, like the Battle of Thermopylae, with 300. You know, the idea that there was only 300 Spartans and there was like 10,000 Persians, but because they were so good, they were just cutting them down. It was a bit like that, but just with him, and he was just killing people for ages. So what eventually the Saxons did, because they couldn't like just kill him outright, one of them snuck under the bridge, and it would have been like a wooden bridge at the time. And he just thrust a spear right up under Harald Hardrada, and apparently just went right up through the bridge and like into his gonads, essentially.
Yeah.
And that was obviously a savage enough blow that then the rest of them could like cut him down. Yeah. But that was also just as an interesting side note. So Harald Hardrada's second in command, and like the second most dominant Viking at the time, was a guy called Ori. Once the battle was lost and Harald Hardrada had died and it was clear that they were not going to win the Battle of Stamford Bridge, Ori and the rest of the men fled back to the boat, and they ended up sort of travelling around Scotland, and they ended up landing in the Isle of Man, and then they ended up conquering the Isle of Man, and then he became King Ori of Man, and then became King of the Isle of Man. And you can actually just go, I've been to King Ori's grave in the Isle of Man. So he's like, obviously in the Isle of Man, like the legend of Ori is like a big deal. And it's even in their national anthem. It's like when King Ori the Dane in Manon did reign, and it's like, oh yeah, it's just cool. That's cool. And that's why, like, to this day, a lot like some of the other little isles in like Britain, a bit like, you know, the Orkneys, and I believe like the Shetland Islands as well, like, you know, they have like a real like strong Viking culture. So it's almost like this mixture of, because apparently when King Ori landed, and then like the Vikings fought what, like the Manxmen, which would have been like Gaelic men, which would have been very similar to sort of like the Scottish and Irish people. And then the Vikings ended up winning, and apparently they just slaughtered all the men on the island.
But not the women.
Yeah, so like everybody that's like got like in Manx blood is like half Gaelic, half Viking.
Whoa.
So like, and it's like really in like in their culture, in the Manx culture, if you ever go there, which I do recommend people go there because it's like amazing, it's almost like a little hidden gem. They call it the jewel of the Irish Sea. But it's like everything there, it's like this really cool mixture between like Gaelic and Viking, like everywhere. They've got these really cool like Viking stones with like runes all carved into them that you can just go and see in the island. As I said, they've got the burial of King Ori, which is cool. You've been
King
to some
Ori's
of the
grave, yeah.
I think you've been to King Ori's
grave. I remember I fell over in King Ori's grave. It was like real bad because it was quite raining. It's like it's like a weird little thing that you can go in into it. Yeah. And I remember something happened. Like
because it's almost like a little. It's like almost like a tomb.
It's like a tomb, but with stones and stuff. And you can like walk into it and actually go into like the entrance.
What's
part
the word
of
I'm
the
trying
tomb.
To think of? It's almost like a cairn.
And I fell over. It was a bit rainy. It was a bit wet at the time. And
King Ori was like, "Oh, you."
I was just thinking with like. You know, you said that Ori went over to the Isle of Man, you know, with the
the rest of the Viking army.
Yeah, but would that have been like a very large number then?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Because it numbers mustn't have been like crazy. Yeah,
like you were saying, with them actually doing like a 300 project sort of thing as well, where they were vastly outnumbered.
They weren't actually outnumbered in terms of, they would have probably a pretty even battle army size at the Stamford Bridge, but it was just that Harold just found the strategic position, and because
which
he was,
reminded you of that,
and
battle,
because he was such a lethal soldier, he just knew that it was a real strategic place, and he was just this absolute berserker, so he was just cutting everyone down.
I think it's quite sad when that happens to like a big warrior. Like going back to the original fact. Sorry, just branching off 1 second.
Oh yeah.
I think that's really sad when it's like when someone's that good at being like a warrior, you would like to think that they get to die in like a valiant way.
Well, that was a valiant way, though, really. You know what I mean? You got to think from the point of view as a Viking. As I said, like the whole thing is like you don't get into Valhalla unless you die in battle. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like if you die of old age in Viking society, it's almost like that's almost like a to be frowned upon sort of thing. Do you know what I mean?
No, I just mean like with the arrows. You know what I mean? I feel like it'd be cool.
Oh, the Japanese guy. Oh, sorry, I thought you were talking about Harold.
So I think it'd be cool if you were this warrior, you would want to die in like a 1v1 like. Just battle.
That's
with,
how badass he was,
with
I
weapons,
guess.
You know, but I mean, like you say as well, it stands to reason how good of a warrior he must
be. I think as well,
that's the only way to beat him.
Yeah. I think as well, that's like one similarity, even though it's at like the opposite side of the world, one similarity between that sort of like samurai mindset and like that Viking mindset, isn't it? It's almost like, you know, it's like death before dishonor. Like, if you die in battle, that's like you've achieved almost like your life's purpose. Like, that's how Vikings and samurais were raised, even though, as I said, they're like, physically completely different, opposite sides of the world. They share that, like, almost everything in their society and culture was like, you must be the greatest warrior. Ultimate, like, honour upon your family if you, like, die in like, you know, in battle and stuff. So, yeah, that's cool, isn't it? Yeah, as I said, going back to Ori, though, like, I don't know if he went back to, like, Denmark and Norway and, like, raised more people first, or if, like, because you've got to bear in mind as well,
even when they'd done the first initial battle, more Viking people would come to the island.
Yeah. You've got to bear in mind as well, though, like the army they would have raised to go to Stamford Bridge would have been like, in terms of like the relative to the age and the times, it would have been massive.
Yeah,
because that battle would have been like one of the biggest battles in Europe that was going around at the time, at the whole of Europe. Meanwhile, you've got to bear in mind the Isle of Man is like a very small place. It's only something like 33 miles long, so like probably the biggest army that say like the people of the Isle of Man could muster. Might not even be like a third of what the original army that was at Stamford Bridge was left, which might have been like how many men Ori had left.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Who knows about the, you know, what kind of weapons they had and stuff, and like how, you know, like if that was your whole culture was about battle and you know the weapons that the Vikings had at the time.
They would
have
probably had
epic,
a bit better weapons than the Manx, I could imagine. Yeah. Mm. Also, but not just because they were such good blacksmiths themselves, but because they were such good traders, and the blacksmiths were very good at that. So, like, the blacksmiths, the Vikings, although they battled with the Saxons a lot, they also traded with them a lot, because when the Vikings first sort of met the Saxons, they realised that the quality of their swords was a bit better. The metallurgy, where their swords were, like, a little bit better. So it's like, if you put them to the test, in like vigorous testing, like the Viking sword would break before the Saxon sword, and that was that was mainly to do with the fact that although they were very similar, like Viking swords and Saxon swords were essentially the same. If you can picture like that sort of generic sword that you would think of, if you've anybody that's seen like Vikings or anything like that, they look the same. But because Saxon had that big network, like the Vikings were sort of quite isolated up in like the north of Europe, obviously like Norway, you know, Denmark, Sweden. So they were almost like a bit isolated up in like the frozen lands, whereas the Saxon people had this massive network and were connected to Rome and the Franks and everything. So they had this big wide network and they had leftovers of like Roman technology and all this stuff. So like they had like access to, I guess, just like texts and knowledge of superior blacksmithing. Whereas I guess it's like the difference between like, if I gave you like, say, like a load of blacksmith tools and I was like, right, go to like a deserted island and learn how to be a blacksmith, I'm sure you'd do a good job and you'd come up with some good stuff. But if I sent you to almost like a college where you were being taught by like amazing blacksmiths, you would obviously make better stuff that way, wouldn't you? So I guess that's like a good way of thinking about it, like the differences.
I always find it really interesting as well when you think of like Japan and things, and what they did with their weapons, like the route they went down with their weapons, how they were like much thinner, but it was like mostly like about the sharpness,
so cutting like, weapons.
Like you know, you think of like samurai swords and like, yeah, I find it really interesting. Like I just ordered this knife for my kitchen, and it's like a traditionally made Japanese knife. And it's so cool. There's something like super cool about it, like the way that it's like hand forged and everything. And but that's that style. Like they went like down this whole completely different kind of route with the technology of how that they would like smith that sword and everything. It's like really interesting, isn't it? Like
just
like the different ways you do it. Like they were more like broader in like Europe and everything, weren't they? Or generally,
yeah. I'm actually really interested in like weaponry. It's one of the things, parts of history I'm most interested in, and like different cultures and the different weapons and stuff. Yeah, so. The Japanese and the Asians in general, like Chinese swords as well. Chinese swords are a bit different than Japanese swords, but they're
similar.
They
would fold their metal, wouldn't they? Like the Japanese would like do like hundreds and hundreds of folds, which would make it like super sharp and super strong for how thin it is.
But it's like a myth, isn't there? I don't know if it's true or not, but there's a myth that if you got like an ancient samurai sword, then and you dropped like a piece of silk on it, the silk would just cut.
They went more the route of like cutting weapons, whereas obviously if you see more like a Viking or a Saxon sword, or a bit later on, like a couple hundred years later in sort of the medieval times, if you think of like sort of like a sword like this, which would have had like a cross guard, and it's a pretty good like 50-50 between a cutting weapon and a stabbing weapon. There's still like a very big, it's almost like they're made so that it's very good at stabbing. It could also definitely cut someone's head off, but if you think about like a samurai sword, it, like, you could impale someone with it, but the edge is not specified in any way to be a stabbing weapon. It's a cutting weapon first. It's a cutting weapon first, a stabbing weapon second. Whereas it's almost like a European sword, what nowadays is called, you can go to what's called like HEMA classes nowadays, and what HEMA stands for, you went to it for a while, it just stands for the History of European Martial Arts. So I think sometimes people don't, you know, you think of martial arts nowadays and you always think of like the Asian martial arts, like taekwondo or karate, or you know, like jiu-jitsu, which although it's associated more with Brazilians nowadays, it actually originates in Japan. HEMA, like, I think people don't realize how seriously like Europeans took their fighting as well, but it was more weapon based. So you can find so many texts, like like hundreds of books, and it's all nothing but sword fighting techniques and ways to disarm your opponent and ways to fight like with a sword and with a dagger, and you know, like obviously the whole way that like there was so much invested into like creating armor that could like keep you alive, and then conversely then they would create new weapons that would be like, you had to kill you even if you were in this armor and stuff. Like it was taken very seriously in Europe. As I said, it is interesting like the differences, as I said, and not obviously just between say that and Europe, obviously, like say like the Middle East, like the Middle Easterners had like their very own interesting weapons as well. And then if in places like
I imagine them like thinner at the bottom by the hilt, and then they went quite wide and like curved,
yeah,
in
scimitars,
in north, yeah, scimitars, and you also have things like kapeshes,
Kukris,
yeah, Kukris, which is Indian, which was an And yet again,
though, Indian.
Yeah, yet again, though, it's like very cutting. It's like almost like Asians. Yeah. For some reason, it was all very cutting. Like if you think the whole point of like the kukri, for anyone that doesn't know what kukri is, it's almost like if you can picture that sort of like knife, it's almost like goes like a boomerang. It's almost like a boomerang, a sharp boomerang on a handle.
But it's weird because the cutting edge is on the inside of like the boomerang.
But that's because it's almost like if you think about like almost like a scythe.
Yeah,
it's designed so that bend is what creates the such force. A good cutting motion. Yeah. And that's why it's such a lethal cutting weapon. But
then when you think of some of the other cutting swords from like more Middle Eastern, it's like
the other way.
Yeah, so the outside of like the boomerang shape would be like the cutting thing because of like the almost like the aerodynamics of how it would be like with the motion, you know. It's really interesting.
Yeah. There are some old Greek swords and also I think like Egyptian swords as well, which not as radical as the kukri, but did almost go up like that. It would be like maybe not so like harshly, like, but you know, almost like in a bend, so it would you know, it would have like be a better cutter. Basically, I said, yeah, I do find stuff like that very interesting, you know. And apparently it was when the British Empire first sort of went into Asia, it's really interesting. I've watched some like cool videos and it was going on about how obviously the Asian sort of weaponry, they sort of evolved to fight other Asians and neighbouring countries and stuff like that. So, and obviously the British had also, like, they'd more evolved to fight people like the French and stuff. So when the British armies went into places like India and fought the Indians, it was very interesting because obviously they had what were at the time what were known as sort of like British sabres and things like that. So
they were quite thin, weren't they?
Yeah, and they actually had a sharp sharp on one edge. Mm. Yeah, and was actually almost like more shaped almost like a samurai sword, but with a different hilt.
Yeah.
One thing that's quite different, and I don't know why this wasn't thought of more in Asia, as you see in Europe with swords is the more time goes on, you can see there's more of like they're evolving hand protection.
Yeah.
So if you think about like Viking and Saxon swords, there's not much hand protection. So you imagine a sword's clashing, and then what would commonly happen is the swords would clash, and then the sword would run down the blade, and then it would end up chopping off the person's thumb, or like chopping off the person's forearm, or if not even chopping it off, at least leaving it like savagely wounded, like broken tendons and stuff. So at first they invented like the cross guard, which would be like, the cross guard is obviously just the bit up here. So the whole reason for that is so that when the sword comes down here, it can't get your hand. And that evolved even more when you think about things like rapiers.
The
and
whole
sabers,
hand
it's almost got like a whole hand protector thing that your hand can sit in. So it's like, yeah, your hand is constantly protected
from each angle.
Yeah, because and it just makes sense as well. But like, people would actively target your hands because obviously, if your hands are incapacitated, you cannot hold a weapon.
Yeah,
and then you're easier to kill. Mm. So, but it's interesting that didn't seem to happen. Like, if you think about a katana, like, yeah, as you were saying, all this technology into the actual blade itself. But the actual handle is actually quite like almost like primitive.
Yeah, like very small.
Yeah,
and like you
tiny
think,
little
yeah.
guard. Mm. Like, you wouldn't protect you at all, really. I bet there must have been loads of hand injuries in Japan. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that'd be an interesting one to look up.
Yeah, definitely. I do think weaponry is, and I said weaponry is quite fascinating. Like the evolution of weaponry, you know. But yeah, you can find some really interesting stories on, like, as I said, like battles between British soldiers, like sword fights between British soldiers and like Indian warriors. As I said, like the British more was sort of like what you think of as almost like rapiers and sabers and stuff, and then
yeah, because that's what I was thinking with like how sharp and the cutting power that ancient samurai swords were like supposed to have. Like, if that was met with a more of a broader sword from Europe at the time, like how they would fare against each other, you know. Like,
I think that the European knight would win quite well,
yeah.
I because even though the samurai swords would be so sharp, they didn't really develop their armor the same. And I think a knight, if you think of like a knight in like full plate armor,
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Fully suited.
With like a sword like that, that's like proper battle ready. For a start, you'd have they'd have the reach advantage, and reach is like a lot in like even like in like boxing, let alone in like sword fighting. Like, reach is very important. It's basically it's like, well, you know, if I can get to you before you can get to me. Yeah. Then it's like, do you know what I mean? Or if I can keep you at a distance that you can't get to me, at the very least. Do you know what I mean? So that's one thing. As I said, plate armor obviously is ridiculously powerful. And I think The main way to get through plate armor is more through the gaps. Through piercing weapons.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So they invented that these really powerful daggers that were almost like had like a were triangular at their base and then went down into like a really sharp point.
Mm.
And they were like, if you can imagine like hammering that down into someone, even in plate armor, it would like manage to pierce the armor.
Mm.
But like, as I said, because they didn't really ever, like, they almost had like, I can't remember the name of the actual armor. But can you think of like say leather. What a samurai wears?
Yeah.
It's almost
with chainmail.
I don't think they even had chainmail.
Did they not?
I can picture what it would look like.
It's almost like bamboo. Not bamboo, but you know what I mean? It's almost like, if, you know, there's like those like straw mats. It would almost be like loads of them, like compiled together and stuff, and then like, you know, things like that on top.
Mm.
Definitely butchering actually what a samurai actually wore.
Yeah.
So sorry for any samurai experts out there that are like idiots.
Try and get a samurai on the pod, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Imagine that, just a little samurai. Just
Last of the Samurai.
Tom Cruise.
I think that's what made me think chainmail, because I swear on his samurai armor he's got chainmail. Like, I think so.
Can you
Google
Bullwinkle or Drew, whoever? Can you just Google, did samurais wear chainmail? I'm pretty sure they didn't have that technology. I'm pretty sure that was like a European thing. Do you know what I mean? The same way that like the Asians invented like fireworks and we didn't have them until. And a bit like how.
Okay. So Kusari Gusuku.
All right.
Chain armor is the Japanese term for mail armor. Kasuri is a type of armor used by the samurai class and the retainers in feudal Japan. So yeah, they did.
Oh, they did have chainmail then.
Armor, yeah.
Oh, cool. When did they invent that then? So did they invent that, or was that after they'd met the Europeans?
1270s.
Oh, okay. Right. So they definitely did invent it themselves then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. So they did actually have it then.
Yeah, interesante.
Would you also, just because I think they're really cool weapons, would you also look up a kopesh? I think it's like K-O-P-E-S-H. Like,
yeah, the thing is, we won't be able to see it on the.
Oh, we not?
No, we've not got
have we not got the thing up today?
Yeah. No, we've not got it on, man.
Oh, that's a shame. Oh, don't worry.
But the kopesh, that looks cool.
Yeah, it's a cool weapon.
For anyone watching right now, just type up kopesh. K-H-O-P-E-S-H. E-S-H, not E-S-H.
Does it say like where it originates from? I think it might originate from like Egypt or something.
Let's
have a look.
It just says what it is, but where
I can't
did
even spell it right, so I can't
from?
Even figure out what it looks like.
Let's have a look. I'll have a little look as well.
How's it spelled, Drew?
It's like K-O-P-E-S-H.
K-H-O-P-E-S-H, yeah.
Kopesh.
I see. Yeah,
they look cool, though, don't they?
Yeah, I think it's Egypt, because it says found with Tutankhamun.
I was going to say it looks Egyptian.
Yeah, I thought it was. But yeah, can you see how it's got that, like. It's almost like goes straight at the start, and then it's got that like
hook.
You can imagine that'd be pretty savage, can't you?
Mm.
It's a sickle-shaped sword that evolved from battle axes.
Who was it that used? I know there were some people that used like daggers and stuff where they would be like twisted, so that if you were to put it in someone, like stab it in someone, when you pull it out, it would almost like twist all like the entry
twisted.
Point and like literally rupture like everything inside of you. And it's like considered one of the most deadly like.
Oh really?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't really know exactly what you mean by like a twisted dagger.
Like it would almost have like three sort of things like.
It's like spinning around.
Yeah, kind of.
Oh, that looks crazy.
What's that, man?
Poshlan twisted Damascus dagger.
Yeah.
It looks a bit like a corkscrew, but like sharp on each on all the way around on the points and stuff.
Mm, right.
It looks pretty crazy.
Cool. Yeah, pretty funny as well how literally did one quick fire fact and we just like spiraled off on this
quick
like, massive
fire fact.
The weapons are actually so interesting.
Oh, they are fascinating.
For how much like death and destruction they deal.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So interesting as well.
Yeah.
I used to be that's another I know what we were talking about on Mystery Mondays as well, like this week. And about like, you know, past lives and stuff like that. And like It's almost like there's this, for me when I was a kid, like, I was like strangely obsessed with swords and knives.
Oh, me too.
Like,
man.
Yeah, like before I was,
I had
even
so
been
many
exposed
toy swords.
To,
yeah.
to like, to much about, like,
yeah.
you know what I mean? And it is, it's like there was this like,
thing inside
thing
you.
It's just like, I'm a warrior.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, I was exactly the same. If we were ever in a shop and it'd be like, oh, Cam, do you want a toy? You've been a good boy recently. I'd be like, want a toy sword.
Yeah.
I'd go to like find like a little toy sword in the shop and I'd want that.
Yeah, I was obsessed apparently. Like there's that picture. I put it on like Facebook a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
Just I'm just
Action
in a
Drew.
In a pair
Rambo.
Of pants
yeah.
and some wellies, and then I've just got about like 20 daggers and knives yeah. all just like stuffed into my pants and like and a yeah. bow and a bow on, and it was literally
like some
like,
weird little like Ranta. Yeah. Some little like Rambo Conan hybrid.
Yeah, just looking at yeah. the camera like
Yeah. yeah man, oh, it's just fun, isn't it? It's
yeah.
cool. Give you another quick fire fact now. There's an English man named Mark Roberts who has streaked at more than 565 international events.
Oh.
He has his own set of rules for streaking. Don't interrupt the play of game. Be prepared to spend an evening in jail. Have a good lawyer on hand. And don't eat spicy food the night before a streak.
Ooh, that sounds like good rules.
Yeah,
yeah, doesn't it?
I wonder why.
Why he's I wonder, yeah, he's just become this pro streaker almost. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the first football game. I haven't been to many football games in my life, but the first one I ever went to, there was a streaker that ran out onto the pitch.
Oh, was that?
Nice. I was like, yeah, that's pretty
far?
Interesting. Yeah, right out into the middle.
Did
right
it?
Out into the middle and was there, like, jumping around and that. Like, yeah.
Brilliant. In the 14th century, ships would catapult beehives onto the decks of enemy ships to clear the way for boarding parties. That's a bit savage, isn't it?
So they'd what, sorry?
Catapult beehives onto the decks of enemy ships to clear the way for boarding parties.
To clear the way.
So if they were like hunting down another ship.
Hmm.
So they would catapult the beehives on so that they could, yeah, so that the men had sort of all been like cleared
yeah.
and ran off all hysterically
yeah,
when
yeah,
by
yeah.
the time they'd boarded the ship. Let's get you another quick fire fact. Sarah Wilson, who was born in the 1700s, was an English con woman who often travelled in the United Kingdom, presenting herself to be of royalty, and she conned many lower-class families. She was convicted as a thief in the 1770s. She, however, managed to escape to America and lived like royalty for the rest of her life under the guise of a Princess Carolina Matilda. Sort of like impressed almost in a way that she managed to make like a full career
Fake
out of that.
Fake it till you make
yeah.
it.
Yeah, she literally did it. She just like lived a life of royalty in America. Everyone just sort of like, I guess, were just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool.
Fair play.
This is quite a cool one. Monkeys in Japan have learned to wash sweet potatoes in fresh water to clean them, but they have recently switched to washing sweet potatoes in salt water. Scientists have theorized that this is because they like the salty taste of the potatoes more than the plain potato taste.
Nice.
So it's a bit like when we season our potatoes before we roast
yeah.
them. I mean, that makes sense to me, though.
Seasoning
I think,
all round,
imagine,
baby.
Like, having a roast potato, but you haven't seasoned
oh,
it.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, you know...
Having anything, really, when you haven't seasoned
oh,
it.
I know.
Like, yeah, you know?
When people tell me that they don't have, like, salt and pepper and stuff on their food, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What?
Bit of olive oil, bit of rosemary, bit
yeah.
of salt. Oh,
that's crazy. Like, to me, that's, like, crazy, man. That's crazy.
I loved that thing. I still always, whenever we talk about monkeys, I always go back to that thing of you showing me the orangutans, like, fish.
Oh, well, that's
like
a fish.
Went fishing, and then
yeah.
like the fact that they were in their one particular species of them have now entered their stone
the stone age.
Age.
No,
that's
so
cool.
Yeah, that's slightly different. So there's orangutans that like observed people fishing in Asia and then have started fishing themselves. But then there's the chimps. It's the chimps that have entered the stone age. So that wasn't through them observing humankind, as far as I'm aware. It's just that scientists have observed that some tribes of chimps have entered the stone age.
Mm.
They've started using stones as tools, so they've officially entered the stone age, which is just really cool, isn't it?
Another fact that I find really interesting with like animals and species, I can't remember it specifically, but it was basically after a certain amount do a certain thing, then the whole species like
hive mind.
Yeah, it's like that technique or that thing gets just like implanted into everyone.
It's like the equivalent, like the mental equivalent of like, you know, when they say like herd immunity.
Mm.
You know when they say like, oh no, the best way to get immune to a virus.
Herd immunity
is like to, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's that equivalent. Yeah, you know they say like the best way to get like a species like used to like a virus or whatever is to just let it spread through the community,
yeah,
and then you'll get like a herd immunity, and after a while it won't be any worse than a cold.
Mm.
That was like the yeah, it was weird because when COVID first came out, I remember that was originally Boris Johnson's plan. Do you remember? Boris Johnson
really.
Went on the and he said that he was going to let coronavirus spread through the community, and so we would get herd immunity. And then like loads of stuff happened and kicked off, and then suddenly it was like no lockdown. But like that was the original plan.
I'd be curious, thinking of those chimps that have entered their stone age, I'd be curious if like, think of humans, for example, now that everyone's got phones, right, there would have been a time when no one had phones.
Yeah.
But there are still the few people that are like, you know what, I'm not getting a phone.
Yeah, like old like people. Before phone. And, yeah.
So I wonder if there are chimps about that all the other chimps are like, right, we're going to start using tools, we're going to start using stone, and they're like, no.
Nah, man.
I'm not sticking to the old ways.
I'm not keeping this crazy tech.
Yeah, man.
I'm just going to just do it all with my hands, bro. Mm-hmm.
So what about the bears then, who observe the
nature.
The beauty
yeah,
of nature?
Yeah.
Isn't
yeah,
that a part
so
of,
cool.
you know, progression?
Mm. Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? But like, I think if you're a bear, I don't think you even really need tools. Because you're such a unit.
You got tools on the ends of your fingers.
Did yeah, that come out this past week, that news? That they can, like, observe beauty? Or did you just tell us that?
I was a fact I said last week.
Ah, right.
At the end of the episode,
yeah.
It was, like, the end of one of my quickfire facts. But, yeah, it is cool. I remember saying, like you said, one of the reasons I don't think bears necessarily need it. I don't think that there's many things that a bear does. I mean, I might be wrong. I'm just thinking on the spot. That like a bear does that like, could really be improved that much with say like stone tools. I know for example that like
well, they haven't got opposable thumbs, have they?
No, they haven't. No, that's a good point. Yeah, but I mean I've also heard stories of like say like hunters and stuff that say they've observed bears in the wild, like with one arm like lifting up like massive boulders to like look underneath for like grubs and stuff to eat. And they said that afterwards, like when the bear has cleared off, they've like gone up to the boulder and like,
tried
so, like
to have it,
two or three men like can't move it like an inch, but the bear with one arm was just really casually like the same way that like you'd like lift up a coffee mug. Probably it wasn't like it was just like
that's mental.
But it's like and also it's a pretty brutal video. We can't show it to people anyway today. But I watched a video of like a bear. Attack a moose and then it like dragged the moose off. But you know how like massive moose are?
Yeah.
So they're probably twice the size of like a massive stag or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how heavy moose are. Google
I'll
it?
That.
Because I know whatever it is, it's gonna be really heavy. It's gonna be something ridiculous like
2 ton? 1 ton?
Take a guess.
I reckon like
I'm putting the average, so.
Yeah, I mean I reckon say like an imperial ton at least. What's that, 500 kilos?
So male is 380 to 700 kilograms.
Yes.
Female, 200 to 490.
Yeah, so if it's say 700 kilos, that's over an imperial ton.
For the big bulls, yeah.
Yeah, for the really big bulls. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and in the video, the bear's like dragging off the moose, but it's like, oh man, it's like how I
like
would...
Like a toy.
It's like how I would pull around like a small woman. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know when you watch something, you're like, that's like, it's almost like, that's weird.
That's pretty easy.
That's weirdly easy.
Yeah.
You know? I think one of the things that makes somebody like, you know, when you're like younger and you're watching pro wrestling, like one of the reasons I was always like such a big fan of say like people like Bill Goldberg and Brock was because I've always been really interested in sort of athletics and stuff. The reason I was such a big fan of them is because they have that weird freakish thing where it's like, a lot of wrestlers like lift other wrestlers and they suplex them and stuff, but it was the way that when someone like Brock or Bill did and it had this weird like effortlessness to it, and it makes you think like, oh my god.
And like speed as well.
Yeah.
Like they were speedy as well as strong, weren't they? Like,
and I think that's what bears have, but like obviously on another level. It's like when like the way that the bear like pulled the moose across the ground, it was scary, man. It was like, I was like, whoa, like that's a moose. That's like literally the largest mammal in North America, and the bear was like pulling it around like it was a child. You know what I mean? It was like crazy, man. It was crazy,
cray cray.
Shout out to the bears. But yeah, I'm not sure if bears would need it, but it's cool that bear can literally just sit there and contemplate nature and think, oh, this is pretty beautiful. Oh, this is a pretty nice scene.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love that fact so much.
Oh, if I had a camera right now, I'd take a picture of this. That's pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Take a mental note.
Yeah. We've run out of time in the first hour, so let's listen to some tracks. I was going to reel off another quick fire fact, but we'll leave it there for the time being. Listen to these tracks and come back in the second hour. We're going to find out all about a cult. A local cult, actually. A cult that was actually super local to us, just a couple of miles away from us.
Oh, I'm excited.
And we've got plenty more quick fire facts and a couple of other stuff to talk about. So, yeah. Cheers, everybody. We are now going to find out all about a sex cult.
Ooh,
so this is
my kind of cult.
Oh, babe. Yeah, babe.
All right.
All right. So this is the Spaxton sex cult of the 1800s.
Wow.
So people that listen to us locally obviously will know where Spaxton is. For people that don't, Spaxton is a village that is about 4 miles from where we are recording this right now. And they had a cult called the Agapemone back in the 1800s.
Yeah.
So I've known about the Agapemone for a long time, but there's what reminded me of it recently was there was this newspaper article from a local newspaper, the Mercury. So I'm going to read it out to you and then fill in any blanks with prior knowledge I already had on the Agapemone. So it says, "It was a little awkward in January 1899 when the Son of God died near Bridgewater, considering he was supposed to be immortal. Several soul brides and his daughter, the child of the devil, succeeded him, and he was buried standing up just so he was ready for action when the resurrection occurred. But if you believe the rumours, he'd had more than enough action during his lifetime."
Ooh.
"This is the story of the Agapemonites, a mid-1800s sex cult centered in the heart of all places, Spaxton, that scandalized Victorian society. The Reverend Henry Prince was the youngest child of a West Indian plantation owner, born in Bath in 1811. He underwent a religious conversion in 1834, and the following year he gave up a career in medicine for his spiritual calling. In March of 1836, he entered St. David's College, Lampeter, but soon got himself something of a reputation for his strange beliefs. His first curacy was at Charlinch, where he proved himself to be a charismatic and popular preacher, although one with some unorthodox views about sex. When he began flinging himself around the room and prophesying, word reached the Bishop of Bath and Wells, who asked the rector to rein in his curate. This didn't go according to plan, however, and instead the rector converted and became Prince's follower, prompting the bishop to revoke both men's license to preach in the name of God. In 1842, Prince obtained a temporary curacy in Suffolk, but with the words, 'In me you see Christ in the flesh.' He proclaimed himself to be the Messiah, and the Church of England promptly defrocked him. Undeterred, Prince continued to gain followers, especially in Brighton and Weymouth. For some reason, it seems super random that it was randomly in Brighton. Like, Brighton's the opposite coast. Do you know what I mean? So, like, Spaxton in Somerset is, like, pretty much on the west coast. Like, just, like, a few miles from the west coast. And Brighton's, like, the east coast. So that's really random, isn't it?
To all the piers.
Like, I mean, you can at least see, like...
That's where he's preaching.
At least Weymouth's still southwest. Yeah, just a bit random, isn't it? It's just a bit random. So where was I? His gospel also attracted many young unmarried women and older widows. One day, Prince gathered them all in a large house in Weymouth and solemnly informed them the end of the world was nigh.
What?
They were told that all possessions, including money, would be meaningless in the face of oblivion, so they should share them for the common good. And just like that, the Agapemone, or the Abode of Love, as it was also known, became a reality. Using the money, the group bought a 200-acre estate in Spaxton, complete with a great house with some 18 bedrooms, sitting rooms, dining rooms, and servants' quarters. Spacious grounds and gardens became known as the Eden. They were dotted with outhouses, stables, conservatories, gazebos, and cottages. It had its very own chapel in one corner, with easy stairs, settees, and a billiard table. The estate was also surrounded by a high brick wall to keep prying eyes out, and the faithful in. Enormous bloodhounds guarded the gates. But it was his practice of keeping spiritual wives, as he called them, and accusations of theft, kidnapping and brainwashing that finally brought the cult to the attention of British newspapers. In 1845, three of the Nottage sisters travelled to Somerset, along with Prince, to reside in the new community. During the journey, Prince persuaded Harriet, Agnes and Clara Nottage to marry three leading clergymen from the Agapemini. Harriet married Reverend Lewis Price, Agnes married Reverend George Thomas, and Clara married Reverend William Cobb. They all wed in Swansea on the 9th of July, 1845. Clara and Harriet would live happily in the abode of love with their spiritual husbands for many years. But after becoming with no right to remove her cash, after angering Prince, a pregnant Agnes was later banished from the church and branded a fallen woman. When Agnes realized Prince had his set sight on another sister, Louisa, she wrote to her, telling her not to come to Spaxton. So Louisa came to Agapemini to live. Alarmed, her outside family decided to free her. Late one night, drinkers at the Lamb Inn, next door to the Agapemini, heard frantic screaming. They rushed out to see a young woman being bundled into a coach, which clattered noisily off into the dark of night. Louisa remained utterly convinced that Henry Prince was God, and her mother had her committed to a lunatic asylum. She managed to escape, only to be recaptured and recommitted. But her friends in the sect alerted the commissioners in lunacy, who investigated and released her in May of 1848. After her release, Louisa sued her family for abduction and false imprisonment, and won, remaining at the Agapemini for the rest of her life. The case of Louisa Nottage was the first time that the general public via the newspapers had heard of the Agapeminists, but it would not be the last.
Can I just say, it's so cool, like, being able to place all of these places as well.
Yeah.
Like, my brother, of course, used to live over in... What is it
Spaxton.
Called? No, but he actually lived by... Is it Charlinch?
Charlinch, yeah.
Yeah, he lived in, like, Charlinch Manor.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
had
yeah,
a house
yeah.
sit there, and then there's, like, that creepy church right
next
to
Charlinch
it.
Church.
Yeah, and then my ex-girlfriend lived in Spaxton, too, and, like, worked at the Lamb Inn, like, right next to the place and everything.
Yeah, I've been in the Lamb quite a few times for a steak. Yeah. It's quite a good, nice place to go for food.
Mm.
Yeah, they do, like, good steak and chips there and stuff, and they're the sort of place that, like, if you ask them to give you an egg with it, they will.
Didn't Jess White live in... Or Jess Mann,
Jess
sorry,
Mann.
Live in the old something that was to do with
I
the
can't
Agapemini.
Remember if she lived in the... She might have actually lived in the Agapemini.
Yeah, yeah, I think she
Whoa.
Did.
I think
Ask
she
Emily.
Might have done, yeah. I'm pretty sure she did.
Yeah, I remember her saying she'd go around there and it was like that was the place that was
I'm
the
pretty
house.
Sure like her dad bought it and like did it up and then they lived there for a while.
But it was like a real nice big house, like, you know.
Yeah, actually I've got a cool story about that, like, so I can tell you.
Do you reckon it's cheaper because of all of this as well?
Mm.
Like, it brought the price down a bit.
I reckon
it's
a long old time ago now, though, as well. I don't know where...
It might do. I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe.
Does
some...
it say in this article about when the fall of the Agapemini was?
We shall come on to that...
So we'll see.
...shortly. The incident, which would forever fix them in the imagination as an evil sex cult, came in 1856, when Prince announced something he called the Divine Purification. Prince said he would carry out the sacrificial deflowering of a young girl to prove that he was the Son of God. Before,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's going to prove that I'm the Son of God just
by just
deflowering
be deflowering
you.
A load of ladies. I mean, come on. Before long, a selection of suitable girls was made available in the chapel so he could choose the one to be favoured, as he called it. Mm. In front of a large congregation of his followers, dressed in flowing red velvet, he had full sexual intercourse with a 16-year-old girl on a billiard table. This is mental. Can you imagine what? And all of his followers were just around him watching. I can imagine them all just like chanting.
Man, this is like something out of Midsummer.
I know, I was thinking that, actually. The girl was violated to the sound of the chapel organ and the singing of strange hymns. He assured his followers the girl would not become physically pregnant, but who would give birth to the spirit of the new Messiah. so eyebrows were raised among even the most devout followers when it became apparent the girl was actually pregnant. The resulting child that was born 9 months later was called Eve. She was condemned and denied by Prince as a devil child and what was not hell? Recognized by him what? As his flesh and blood. Their blinkers were finally removed. Many of the congregation left, and at the same time, the walls were built higher, and no one allowed in, obviously. This just meant gossip and speculation went into overload. Rumours escalated, tales became taller, and more journalists dropped in, using the Lamb Inn as a base to gather gossip and buzz from the locals. A favourite tale was how Mr. Prince would choose his next female companion by sitting on a revolving stage and seeing who was in front of him when it stopped turning.
The young ladies, but with yourself.
The young ladies were said to have then stripped naked to bathe him. Prince outlived many of his followers, giving further credence to his claim of immortality. In 1896, aged 85, he emerged from behind the walls of Spaxton to initiate the building of an ornate church in Clapton in North London, complete with a 150-foot tower of Portland stone.
Once again, bouncing from coast to coast.
Yeah.
Just the capital now, just in the middle of London.
Yeah. Yeah, the place was complete with an 150-foot tower of Portland stone, oak hammerbeam roof, and stained glass windows depicting the submission of womankind to mankind. The church was dedicated to the Ark of the Covenant, and one of the first preachers appointed was the Reverend John Hugh Smith Pigott. In 1899, Prince finally died at the age of 88. His followers were confused and hurriedly buried him in the grounds of the chapel, with his coffin positioned vertically so that he would be standing on the day of his resurrection.
Damn.
Yeah, weird.
It's crazy how he like got away with like so much stuff there.
Yeah. Just built like massive walls and was like, oh, basically, I'm the son of God, and I'm just going to do all these like crazy deflowering ceremonies, and everyone's just like, oh, yeah, that's cool. And there's just like weird organ music playing, and everyone's like chanting weird hymns, where he's just like having sex with this 16-year-old girl on a billiard table. For some reason, it makes it weird that it was a billiard table. It almost makes it a bit comedic. Do you know what I mean?
Things quite comedic. On a billiard. I can't believe it was so close to us.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's another example of fake it till you make it.
I always think it's like amazing when you hear stuff like that. It's a bit like Charles Manson's cult as well, how it's just like, oh yes, and then you hear stories about how like loads of people flocked to him. I was like, what?
Yeah,
like who?
Yeah.
What sort of, who were these mental people that I thought, this sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? How do you get away with it? How with building a cult like that?
Yeah, this guy says he's the son of God, does he? Oh, right, well, yeah, I guess. Yeah, we'll just go and join him.
So weird. Crazy. It's like people have this overwhelming want to fit in. Yeah. And then they have to fit in these weird places that no one else fits in.
Yeah.
But then they do fit in.
Yeah.
And they're all of a sudden.
And then next thing you know, they're being rogered on the billiard table to load of weird organ music, you know? And hymns.
It reminds me of like The Handmaid's Tale.
What's
weird.
That?
There's this thing, I think it's on Netflix. Netflix
rings a bell, I don't think
Amazon
I've seen
Prime.
It.
But I watched it and it was proper freaky. It was like fertility started going down in America and everything and in the whole world. And then there was only certain women could have kids.
Right.
And they, America like closed off its borders and like basically took all the women that could still have kids and like you like made them these weird like handmaidens that were like, it was like a Christian cult. That was basically, and they did this thing that was like the ritual, like once a month, where like the masters of the household would that their wives would hold down the handmaids on the bed, and then they'd like rape them and stuff, just because they want to get babies still, but they weren't able to with their wives, but it was all made like this like religious thing, you know. It's like a TV program, and it's a complete fiction, but it's like you can imagine things.
Well, it sounds
weird,
like similar to this,
in
terms of the weirdness. Yeah. It's like it's just
I reckon
as weird.
This is where they got their inspiration for the show. From but it's really cool as well, though, because this woman's like trying to escape and stuff, and like, and Canada is like the safe house, like safe haven.
Oh,
where
really?
It's happening,
cool.
And it's like how escape they get Canada. Like, yeah, you know, it's really good.
Is it one
I've
of those shows where you're almost when you're watching it, you're like, oh, this is messed up.
Yeah, it is, yeah, definitely. But you can almost imagine it happening as well, like, What's it called? Like extremist like people. That really believe certain things like that, and like the things that they'll go to, like to.
It almost seems almost like comical in a way, doesn't it? Though, with this like Reverend Prince guy, how he was just like he's like, don't worry, when I have sex with this 16-year-old girl, she won't get pregnant, and then she just got pregnant, and he was like, no, it's the son of the devil.
Yeah,
it's a child of Satan. I renounce you. It's like, what?
So
that's almost
stupid,
just like ridiculous.
It's like, absolutely stupid.
It's actually just like really comical, really, isn't it? You're like, all right, mate. But we're obviously
like,
just like
really
for
get
the crap.
Much more proof than that.
Yeah. It's funny to think that literally went on like just like down the road from us.
Yeah, crazy.
I want to see the Agapemni house.
Yeah, so I think there was a girl that was in our tutor group at school, as we were talking about, called Jess Mann, and I'm pretty sure she lived there for a while. I'm not sure if this is the same place as well, but I think Em was telling me, I don't know if this was this place or not. Oh no, actually, I don't think it was. There's anyway, there is one story that Em told me about how she was with a friend. I can't remember if this was this place in the Agapemini or if this was this place in Chad's Hill in Cannington. But anyway, she was telling me that she was with like a girl, and they were like like the dad had bought the house and they were doing it up. And she was like with one of her girlmates. I can't remember if it was Jess Mann or if it was one Em's old friend Emma Kent, I think her name was. And they were saying that they were like playing, like just like chucking a ball to each other. And apparently the house was like pretty empty, like they just moved in, and their sort of parents were sort of wandering around the house downstairs. But they were upstairs just like playing ball. And then one of them like chucked a ball to the other one, and like they didn't catch it, and it like went into a room. Like the ball just like went into a room, and then suddenly the ball just like flew out the room. And it was just like a completely empty room.
Oh man, that's so freaky, isn't it?
Yeah,
man, that's horror movie stuff.
That's meant to, and apparently they were
just
like
rolling back out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Emma Kent as well said that, as I said, I don't know if it was the Agapemini or this house in Carrington, but that Emma Kent, I think, used to say that like stuff used to, like things used to come out of her wardrobe in the middle of the night.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Freaky.
Yeah, like she just be like,
what's like clothes?
No, like something,
like
someone or something, like in the middle of a night, like every now and again, like the wardrobe would just open and like she just see something like climb out of it, and then she'd like scream, and then her parents would run into the room and turn the light on, and then like would just be like nothing there, but she'd like see in the darkness like a wardrobe going, and then something like get out. But then by the time she'd like screamed and the parents were coming, it was like nothing there. So it was like, I don't know, like some ghost or something. That's what she thought. Maybe it was just like sleep paralysis or like a nightmare. Yeah, but
still,
creepy story nonetheless.
Yeah, whatever the case.
Whatever
that's
it was,
terrifying.
It was a pretty creepy story. Yeah,
100%, 100%.
Yeah, because I like, remember Emma always like saying she was like really always like freaked out to stay there.
Yeah.
She'd like stayed at our house a couple times. But I think Em said that even when she stayed, apparently the light used to like randomly flicker. So they'd have like a light on in my bedroom, and suddenly just randomly just go like, you know, it's almost like it's like flickering on and off. Whoa. Maybe it was just faulty electrics or something.
I want to know these things. I remember where I went to like a ghost hunter at Mansell House once.
Oh yeah,
and they had these like things that were like, are they called like EVF meters or something?
Oh,
and electro.
I don't know if it's
that the little things with like beeps when
yeah,
when
like
a ghost presence.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's something like any like you if there's like a radiation or something or some kind of
if
frequency that happens around it. It was like it would light up and like kind of beep and stuff. But it was like really crazy because when we were there doing kind of ghosty things, you could ask questions and it would like beep twice for yes or like beep once for no and that, and it was like really weird. You could it would actually like light up and stuff, and it was like, I wonder what that actually was. I want to get one like for my own house or something.
We got to do Pandora's Box goes ghost hunting or something.
Oh, that's so cool.
There's so many like cool haunted places near us as well.
Definitely, as I said, the Jamaica Inn, apparently. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Jamaica Inn is supposed to be the most, like one of the most, if it's not the most, it's one of the most haunted places in the entire of the UK. And it's like, I can't remember if it's North Cornwall or South Devon, but either way, it's not that far from us. Like, we could get there in like a couple
hours. I definitely end up freaking myself out, but that is partly the point. So I'd enjoy
all cameras on you, bro.
It's proper weird how you can freak yourself out, like
psychological.
Yeah, like I went through years of not really doing it. And like, as in, like, I used to like hate it as a kid. Like, I could freak myself out, and then I'd just be like, I'd feel horrible being like somewhere like on your own in that.
It's like myself out.
It's just horrible just being somewhere on your own.
Yeah.
That seems almost like really ominous. I'm like, what aren't you telling us, man?
Yeah, no, like,
what are you doing?
But I was in my house the other day and I freaked myself out.
How?
Yeah. Just by thinking differently. Yeah, like I came downstairs and it was like the middle of the night. And, like, you know, I can sit in my living room in the pitch black, like, no problem at all, and just not be worried, like, at all. Like, just, like,
normally.
Like, not in the but then, yeah, I came down the stairs. Oh, it was when Meg was at Wellington,
right,
so I was in there completely on my own.
And you're thinking you've only lived there for a little while,
yeah,
so you don't know.
And then I was thinking, I wonder what, like, the actual energies are like in this house. I wonder if there is any kind of, like, history, because I know it's a really old place and stuff. And you know, it so used to called. Be the little road behind us, or the little thing. Mm. It there used to be like a stable lane for a horse and cart and stuff. It's like a really like old place.
Yeah.
And I just got down to the bottom of the thing, and I had that thought. And when I had that thought of like, I wonder if there's anything around here, like any like imprints of a memory or anything of like people that had lived here. And then, yeah, I freaked myself out. And I was, like, standing at the bottom of the stairs, like, looking through the hallway, like, into where the kitchen is in the bathroom. There's, like, a little light coming from the kitchen window just, like, flickering a bit. And I was just a bit like, all right, yeah, I'm going back upstairs.
Yeah.
And I went back upstairs.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But it was, like, but I knew it was stupid. But just from that change of perspective, I freaked myself out. And I was like,
man.
Oh, I've still got it. I can still do it.
I did it yesterday in here.
Really?
Did you?
In here, man.
I remember
studio.
You messaged me and said that you came in here late last night.
So I got here at like, what, 10, I reckon it was?
I think it was about, like quarter to 10 or
something.
Yeah,
I got here like around 10 and then ripped my movie review for my breakfast show. And I just watched Midsommar right before I came in.
Midsommar.
So I came in like, and like we were saying, it's not a movie where you feel like someone's coming to get you, but it's a movie where you're
it's
kind
more
of
like,
a little,
I'd say,
like, oh.
A bit depressing. And just like a weird mixture of weird and depressing. Like it's twisted and depressing.
Yeah. And for some reason, I find this, whenever I come here in the night, it's quite a creepy.
Well, it's an old Georgian house.
It's a very Georgian house. Like, when it's dark, it's dark.
Yeah, especially like the cellar bit downstairs.
Yeah, and it's got that big old door at the end of like the cellar and stuff like that.
And
like,
where
like,
we did Jimmy
and
Ali.
Yeah, Jingle Balls, yeah.
And because the floors, I don't know how old the floor is and stuff, but there's constant
creaking.
Like wood creaking and stuff,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, it's an old house, man.
So I sat here, and then at one point, when I left to go, I was like literally ran pretty much from like that
did
room.
You?
After I set the alarm, I was like, right. Time to go. And I like, got my keys.
Yeah,
I got my keys and almost like pretend this is my keys. I was like, just in case, so I could like.
Well, yeah, this is probably like one of the oldest houses in town.
It's a creepy house, man, and it's the fact you don't really know what's underneath. That
I said it's called as almost like a nickname. It's called Lion's House because it's got lions at the bottom of the stairs outside.
Mm.
But its technical name is Benjamin Holloway House, isn't it? It was built by a man called Benjamin Holloway. He was like a very wealthy man in the Georgian period. But I think for a while, I think it was the house of the mayor of Bridgewater.
Mm.
So yeah, it goes right back to the Georgian period. So it was like hundreds of years old. So yeah, who knows, man?
It's funny, whenever you do freak yourself out, I always find that you end up feeling hyper alert.
Yeah,
oh, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like,
it is, it's just your...
Every little thing, you're like... Whereas like normally, you won't even pay attention to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You just ignore
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Rubus House, the other sort of... the other building in town, that is... part of the company
Aspenwaite,
yeah. That one is supposedly like properly supposed to be haunted, and there were
Whoa.
I know that there were like old employees like back in there that would like refuse to be the last one there.
Whoa.
They would refuse to be the last
childhood
one there.
Childhood home, man.
Yeah, and they would and there were also employees back in the day as well that would refuse to go into the cellar. So we used to use the cellar as like for like filing
file
and stuff. Well, we still do. But there would be people that would like refuse to go down there on their own.
Whoa.
To like get files and stuff, and there were other people that refused to be the last ones there, especially in winter time when it was all dark.
Yeah, you should get one of those EVF things for Rubus House.
I want to get one just to like try it out.
Weirdly, it reminded me a little bit what we were talking about on the last Mystery Mondays when we were talking about past lives and
reincarnation.
I can't remember what my point is. I can't remember at this point in my life. I can't remember if it was a dream or a real memory, but either way, I know it's not like a fabrication of my mind.
Mm.
I know it's like a memory, but I just don't know if it's a memory of
a
dream
or
an actual memory.
Yeah, yeah.
But weirdly enough, like, yeah, because I lived in that house when I was a little kid, If I ever did see a ghost, it was in Ruba's house, and I have this memory of like needing to go to the toilet in the middle of the night, and I was like really young, but I was like, I think I just had like, because I shared a room with my brother when I was really little, and then I was like old enough to then have my old my own room, so I think I was probably like 5 or something like that.
Right.
But anyway, I have this memory of like needing to go to the toilet in the middle of the night, and it was like 3 stories the house. It's like a 3-story Georgian house, and we'd always have like the bathroom light on, so obviously like, you know, me and my brother could like go to the toilet if we needed to, and you know our way around other than like falling down the stairs, whatever, in the middle of the night. And I just have this like memory of like, where my bedroom was. It was like my bedroom was here, so here, and then my brother's room. I had to pass my brother's room on the way to the toilet, basically. And I have this memory of like walking past my brother's room and like looking in on the right, and then just like seeing like a man like stood right next to my brother's bed, almost like, almost like looking down at my brother. Yeah, he was just like stood like on to the side of my brother's bed, like the side that my brother was leaning.
Man.
And he was just like stood there looking down at my brother.
Mm.
And I even remember that he almost had like, it's funny because obviously
You just left the room.
No, I wasn't in the room, but I was walking past. Yeah, so this is like, this is one of the things that's weird about it. But I even remember, because obviously I didn't have any knowledge of like history at the time.
Uh-huh.
But I even remember like what he was wearing is what you would describe nowadays as like Georgian clothing.
Whoa.
So he almost had like a big, almost like what you would, I don't know, like a big sort of like frilly cravat on.
Uh-huh.
And then almost like big, you know, can you think of like those almost like big boots?
High boots.
Like, yeah, yeah, like leather boots that like fold over at the top, and they almost have like a big metal buckle on them.
Mm.
And yeah, and almost like maybe almost like some sort of like wig on or something like that. And
I
then
love the idea of you just walking past and be like, not my problem.
No, yeah, this is one of the weird things about it though, and this is one of the things I don't really understand, and it makes me think like, you know,
was it a dream?
Yeah, like was it a dream, or like why did I react like this? But like you would think, if you ask somebody how they react in that situation, you'd think that they'd probably be like, oh my god.
Yeah.
But I remember it was almost like a look, and I was like just really casually, then just then went to the bathroom and then like had a wee, and then just really casually went back to bed. So it's just weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, God knows. But like, I don't know, that might, so like, I don't know, I've, that's the only time in my life that I may or may not have seen something paranormal happen. But as I said, it's just so long ago, I can't remember. I can't remember if it's a real memory or not. I know that it happened. I 100% can like guarantee you that like that story is not made up in any shape or form. I literally like swear on my daughter's life. But like, yeah, I don't know.
Whether it's like a fabrication of your mind. Yeah,
but it's a clear thing, and I've had that as I said, I can remember, you know, it's like one of my oldest memories almost, you know, like really like a bit distinct old memory.
I don't know if we've ever gone into this, but have you got any ghost stories?
Not really, no. No, I did like, I used to do
Ouija.
A lot of Ouija boards, and when I was younger, and also like automatic writing. So like,
I remember you saying all
this. Like, so doing that and like just drawing some like weird stuff, but like where it wouldn't be me that was moving my hand.
Drew is a naughty boy.
I remember what was like so interesting about some of the most interesting automatic write-ins that I did was when I remember this one, and it was like a very small picture, and it was like there was shapes being made as I was like doing the automatic write-in. And the only thing that makes me think that this was either a subconscious part of myself, or it was actually like a spirit that was, or like something that wasn't physically there that was making this happen, is because I didn't know what was the picture was going to be. It was like it made shapes, and then all of a sudden there was a point where it became clear what the picture was, and it was like, whoa, and it was like this like little like a person, like a little like boy, like with angel wings, and like, whoa. and it just, but each thing, it took about half an hour for this, like.
So did you
develop.
Think that maybe it was your brother or something?
So yeah, so then I remember at the time, and I told my mum about it, and I gave my mum the picture, and she put the picture in her purse and like kept
so
it and
kept
it forever.
That's lovely,
yeah.
Man. That's
because she actually really believed that it was my little brother.
Yeah.
Like saying like, you know, I'm here, I'm an angel, I'm okay.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, that's the only kind of, but no, I've had like feelings and stuff and like and experiences with things like that, but no ever like physically like seeing like a ghost or something, you know. I felt like things like you know and stuff, but like I like really envy the people who can actually see stuff. Like I reckon my, my sister can see stuff, like my sister can see ghosts and that, yeah, like, or whenever we speak to Claire and she says she actually physically sees like people and stuff.
Claire does.
And like but yeah, like I said about that time, like where I caught my sister when she's...
some people like in touch. I think my mum's a bit like that as
well. Yeah, I think people have different like people are all different.
Sensitivities.
And in different ways. Like I think I'm very like energetic and like I feel like things, you know, and like stuff. Or like if say I am connected with somebody, it's like connected through my body rather than through seeing it. But then Sherelle, I feel like she's pretty disconnected from all that stuff, but she's like seen things and like
I feel like I'm almost like overly casual about things sometimes. Like were you there were you there at the time, or were you there? I know it was me and Josh. I know it was me and Josh and someone else, but it was when before Death by Kai did their last gig the other week, and it was the night before, and we all went down. Obviously, you guys, like you and Josh and everyone had sound check, and we were like setting up the cameras and that as well, and getting a feel for that. And then it was like we were just about to go home. Everyone was about to go home, and I was chatting to Josh in like the gig room, and then from like behind the curtain.
Oh yeah, I was there.
Where all stuff was, there was just something like a real loud like noise. I can't even remember what the noise was, whether it was like a bang or a crash or like what the sort of noise was, but it was just really loud. And then Josh just suddenly went, is there someone behind there? And I just went, no, I don't think so. And Josh just suddenly went, that was a bit weird. But then we just like really, but we just casually like carried on the conversation. But it was like, no, you might think like, yeah, something down there might behind there might have like fallen or something, but the thing is, it's like obviously there was no draft, there's no draft there. It's like an indoors behind a stage, behind a big curtain, and nobody had been behind there for like a good couple of minutes, so you'd think that if something had been like left in a way that it might fall, it would have probably already fallen. So that was just a bit weird.
I tell you, you're not a skeptic, but I'd say you're someone who tries to see the
because I think otherwise then side. How can you expect to be taken seriously if like everything that you can't explain you just suddenly are like go through alien because it almost sounds like silly. But so I think I'm open to the idea, for example, of ghosts or aliens or anything really, but I actually just, I like to think of it, it's almost just like the process of elimination. So it's like, okay, what are the options of what things could be? And then you go through it, and then if you are left still without an explanation, then you're like, huh. So you know I mean, and you're like, oh, okay then. Well, that's quite interesting.
I consider myself to be quite like active-minded, which is probably why I'm always freaking myself out. You know, when I always I've got like always just whenever we used to go out, I'd always have weird stories, and when I'd be like freaked out about something, like this weekend when I saw a UFO.
Oh yeah,
that was cool.
Oh yeah.
But that was something that I was stood down. There's still zero explanation.
That
as
was
to
during
what I saw
that night. On the night that it was the meteor shower, wasn't it?
Yeah. So
yeah, you got a video of it as well, didn't you?
Yeah. The first thing, the thing I got on video, I don't think was aliens. I think that was just a meteor shower.
Yeah.
But the thing after, the only thing that I could have in my brain, obviously I don't know that much about space, but would be a star exploding. That's the, like a supernova or something in you know, and we just managed to catch that moment. That's the only thing that
seen?
I could possibly think.
Do you know what you might have seen?
What may I have seen?
Wait a minute, I just remembered I saved something. I saved an article.
Essentially, ladies and gents, I went out on the weekend, and after we came back, we went for a bit of a debrief at our local field with my friends. And we were sat out there just stargazing. There was a we're passing through like an asteroid belt at the moment, so there was lots of meteors and shooting stars and everything, so we were just star watching. And then we saw this one that was like loads of different meteors going really, really slow. And I still can't really explain what that was. I think that was just meteors. I saw a video from Spain which looked like
similar,
essentially what we saw, and that was explaining it as meteors. But then afterwards, we were all a bit freaked out, probably a little bit drunk as well, so that may take away from the credibility of my story. But my friend was like, what is that behind the tree? So I walk over to the left and I'm looking, and originally I would have thought it was like a lamp because it wasn't up very high, but I realized whatever this was, it was suspended in the air, and it was a bit bigger than a star. Like, there was definitely a little bit of girth to this to this, you know, pitch white star in the sky, more so than you would think of a normal star. Not enough to be like crazy, but enough to be like, that's quite big for a star. Bigger than a star would be normally.
Yeah.
And it just, I called my friend over and was like, come look, come look. And as I was sort of looking at it with my friend, it like almost got bigger and like really bright and like flashed at us essentially. And then just sort of dissipated and disappeared. Didn't go like left or right. Didn't flash in like colours or flash. You know, there was just this one flash, almost like a solar flare on this star. And it just sort of like... and I was like, crazy, what was that? What was that?
That's cool,
but yeah, that was my UFO experience.
Yeah, I don't. To be honest, I don't think this is actually probably what you saw because it wouldn't... This thing hasn't died. But what made me think of it is that like it says was like an article I've literally been reading... within the last couple of days. And it says, billions of light years away, there is a massive ball of hot gas that is brighter than 100 billion of our suns.
No.
Whoa.
100 billion of our suns?
It is tough for the human mind to imagine something so bright, it says. So what is it? Astronomers are not really sure, but they have a couple of theories. It's so bright that it pushes the energy limit of physics itself. Billions of light years away, there is a massive ball of hot gas that is brighter than 100 billion suns. It is tough to... astronomers are not really sure, but they have a couple of theories. They anticipated that it may be a very rare type of supernova, known as a magnetar, but the one can be so powerful that it pushes the energy limits of physics itself. Or in other words, it is the mightiest supernova that I've ever seen as of today.
Whoa.
This object is so bright that astronomers are having a really hard time finding a way to describe it. If it's in fact a magnetar, it's as if nature took each thing we noticed about magnetars and turned it up to 11. I love how that scientist used the Spinal Tap.
Turned up to 11.
Yeah, I love the fact that scientist used the Spinal Tap quote. Claimed by Professor Krzysztof Stanek, who is a professor of astronomy at Ohio State University. And the team's co-principal analyzer, comedically implicating that it is off the charts from a scale of 1 to 10. The object was first detected by the All Sky Automated Survey of Supernovas, which is a small network of telescopes used to spot bright objects in the universe. Although this object is extremely bright, it still can't be seen by the naked eye because it's 3.8 billion light years away, which is an inconceivable distance to mankind.
Mm.
But yeah. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I did. The main thing that popped into my head when I saw it, I said to my friends, like, we've just seen, like, a star die or something. That was my initial reaction, because that's the only thing I can think of that would be, like, a big bang and then just gone. Because you've got to think how long that would take for the light to travel. Like, that would be something billions of years ago that would have happened. So whatever I did see that night was very cool, and I would like to see it again.
Nice one, bro. Yeah, it was cool, man, when you showed me the video. Anyway, we're almost at the end of the show. I'm just going to randomly reel off one quick fire fact to finish off the show.
One more.
Did you know that there's fossilised footprints that date back 20,000 years in Australia? From the stride of the fossilised footprints, it indicates that the man who made them was running at speeds comparable to Usain Bolt, who is, as of today, the fastest known recorded man in history, indicating that maybe prehistoric man could run much faster than we can today. It's cool to think that we
That's
could
all, so cool.
I think Usain Bolt can run something like 28 miles per hour. So imagine
stupid,
that.
Yeah. And you've got to imagine that.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the chances of that being the fastest man of that?
Well,
like,
exactly.
Group, you know?
Exactly. Like that might have just been an average dude. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Anyway, everybody, we've come to the end of another session here this week at Pandora's Box. Thanks for tuning in. We love you. We'll see you next week. I've been Obadiah. He has been
Drooper the Bear,
and he has been
Bullwinkle.
Have a good one, everybody. Can leave you on some tracks now. This is Heart in Hand, babe.